kulture sjećanja u dijalogu. Slušate podcast Fonda za humanitarno pravo.
This is Memory Cultures in Dialogue, podcast of Humanitarian Law Center from Belgrade. My name is Olivera Simic. Today we are talking about inheriting the burden of guilt and how Germany has dealt with its past. Germany presents the unique case of a society that has been forced to come to terms with its past twice within a 50-year period. The first was with the Nuremberg trials and denazification after 1945, and second dealing with communist East Germany past, which came about after 1989. The Nuremberg trials were designed to appeal not only to the German population, but to the world. For the first time, the leaders of a defeated country were brought before an international tribunal and were tried by the victors in procedures based on international law. The 22 defendants represented the elite of the former Nazi state, as well as its institutions and organizations. The Allies' strategy was to first try the most prominent authorities and to conduct follow-up trials later. In Germany, it took two decades until questions about fathers' and grandfathers' roles during the war and Nazi regime were publicly and widely asked. German historical scholarship has been absolutely decisive in the process of knowing perpetrators and making them known. The notion of German guilt, which signifies German society's collective responsibility for the outbreak of World War II, became a part of the post-war German identity. Germans are still shackled to their past, and it greatly influences the way they deal with Europe and the wider world. German children today still have to deal with the difficult hand history has dealt them. The burden of nationality has very much shaped the way in which Germans view themselves and their responsibilities within Europe and beyond. Feeling guilty has become part of the German cultural fabric. How societies deal with unspeakable atrocities, with victims and perpetrators, how justice can be and is done have been themes of my guest today, Professor Susan Karstedt, research ever since. Professor Susan Karstedt joined the Griffith Criminology Institute in Queensland, Australia, and the School of Criminology and Criminal Justice in 2015. Before coming to Griffith University, she taught and researched at universities in her native Germany and the United Kingdom. Professor Karstedt is an internationally renowned criminologist and sociolegal scholar. She is widely known for work on emotions, crime, and criminal justice. She has published more than 20 books and journal issues and more than 200 articles in journals and edited collections on a range of topics, both in English and German, with translations into Spanish, Portuguese, French, and Russian. For her work, she received many awards, and I will mention just a few: the European Criminology Award in 2019, the Freda Adler Award of the Division of International Criminology of the American Society of Criminology, and in 2021, the Beccaria Medal of the German Criminological Society. Professor Karstedt was elected a Fellow of the Academy of Social Sciences in 2020. Welcome, Suzanne. It's a great pleasure to have you here.
Thank you very much, Olivera. It's my pleasure to join you on your blog. I know Olivera since, I think, more than 10 years, and I have always been very impressed by her very important work about, in particular, the region of the Balkans, where, let us say, outsider views often not correct. But Olivera has opened a door to a better understanding of what is going on in that region and how we also can learn from there.
Thank you, Suzanne, so much. Okay, let us start. When you began your research more than 25 years ago, you said you wanted to know about the attitudes held by ordinary Germans towards the Nuremberg trials that were conducted at the time in 1945 and 1946. Why was for you important to start from that point in history?
Actually, it started with the fall of the wall in 1989, when I went with my mother to visit the former GDR, which was just very close to my hometown of Lübeck. And you could take a regular bus service just then across the border, which was opened. And there were posters asking for people to come forward and testify to what, for example, the Stasi, the Secret Service, had done to them. And my mother, who at that time was pretty old, my mother noted that similar signs had gone up after the end of the war, which she had witnessed as a young adult. And she felt like a déjà vu. And that gave me an idea, and I started to research public opinion on the Nuremberg trials and the denazification processes, and to compare this with what was going on in the former GDR. So I got my hands on the original reports of surveys that were conducted by the Americans from 1945 to 1949, and later other surveys that were conducted during the 1950s by then market and political research institutes. So what I could do, I tracked this life force of public opinion and public memory, as I called it, in West Germany, only West Germany. And I was from the start also interested in comparative perspectives.
In your work, you looked at the role of legal institutions in shaping collective memories of the past and explored the powerful emotions involved in this process. Can you tell us a little bit what role do legal institutions and emotions play in shaping collective memories?
So first, I want to say that I am a strong believer in what legal institutions can do. And I agree here with Mark Oziel that trials, but also truth commissions or truth and reconciliations commissions, like in South Africa, are monumental spectacles. So they are drama, courtroom drama sometimes. So legal institutions, and even in the form of an informal tribunal or in the form of Gacaca courts in Rwanda, have an authority that is one of their assets that other forms do not have. My research also showed, my comparative research, that they do not instigate or exacerbate violence in a post-conflict situation. Our criminal justice, and that is the next point, elicits powerful emotions among the public, perpetrators, and victims. But simultaneously, these institutions are designed to cool off emotions, to cool them down. For example, revenge. A court procedure is actually has to deal to manage these emotions. So, for example, what we expect there are expressions of guilt and remorse, or for victims, expressions of sadness, anger, and so on. And we can see also what is always very powerful for me, the photos of the public audience in the Eichmann trial. You can see so many emotions on the faces. Horror. Some express horror, some express sadness, and they are only onlookers on this trial. So in particular, in these exceptional legal procedures and institutions, we expect a strong presence of emotions. But on the other side, legal institutions also provide troves of evidence, even if it is only illegal evidence. And we know that it is restricted. But in the end, it is difficult to deny it and to deny the knowledge. However, we know it can also be ignored. For example, for Germany, it was a particular advantage that when it became a sovereign state again in 1952, West Germany had to sign up that the Nuremberg trials would never be actually annulled, or the sentences would never be amnestied or anything. The Nuremberg trials, all the trials by the Allies, and that also referred to the trials that had been done, and there were loads of them. That is often forgotten that, for example, the commander of Auschwitz, Höss, was actually tried in Poland. And hanged by, and that was done by the Polish criminal justice system. So these had to stand, and that was important. No politician in Germany could ever deny this.
Just going back a little bit, when you talked about emotions in public, the silence and secrecy pervaded in German society after the war and included all ranks of society. So it also reached out deep down into families and through generations. So under cover of the sun, German perpetrators partially and selectively disappeared. But you claim that perpetrators do know the truth about what happened. Is this why it is, or it was important to listen to them rather than to push them into the margins? And maybe under which conditions the perpetrator should be allowed to speak? And I'm asking this because in the Balkans, we have many war criminals who speak out only to publicly deny crimes they were convicted for.
I would like to start with my response first about the silence, how it comes about. And it is clear that perpetrators have an interest in silence. I mean, they don't want to be prosecuted. And also their family members, their colleagues, their comrades, they have an interest too. So, for example, there was quite a network when prosecution resumed, in particular of police battalions, and the mass murder in the occupied countries in the East, that, for example, there were networks of possibly implicated people who warned themselves, who agreed on what they would say, all undercover. So that's very clear that that can happen. Also, perpetrators of mass atrocities cover their traces, and that happened in Germany. We see that in Latin America, for example, through disappearances, or in Australia also. And just for the German case from 1941, Germans tried to exhume bodies and burn the bodies, exhumed from mass graves. There was the infamous speech by Himmler in which he committed those high-level participants to silence. And, for example, German policemen involved in mass killings were sent to a holiday resort afterwards, but not home to their families, so that they couldn't talk to them. So it is clear from the start that this has to be a secret. And coded language is also used, and we find similar coded language in Germany, but also, for example, in Guatemala. And because they, in the end, know what they did, we need them to talk. One way, of course, are criminal procedures or truth commissions. And now the problem is, of course, if they use platforms to deny this. Germany has laws which criminalize Holocaust denial, and other countries have that too. It could be prosecuted as hate crime, but it is important. One thing is important, that we need perpetrators to speak to us. And on the other hand, we need them to speak what has come out as a truth, so that what cannot be denied, what we can do there. And I think I'm in favor of criminalizing denial, because I think that gives perpetrators the opportunity to tell us the truth and not cover it up.
You talked about importance of criminal trials, and you also said that sometimes outsiders forget that there was thousands of criminal investigations with 100,000 of suspects that started after 1945 in domestic courts, German courts, beside the international proceedings at Nuremberg. And only a fraction of these suspects were sentenced. So these trials are still, as you know, ongoing in domestic criminal courts as of today. What do you think when Germany will finish its process of dealing with its past, and whether prosecutions have now, in this time and age, any meaning once victims die due to passage of time, since, you know, they cannot experience satisfaction of seeing their perpetrators behind the bars?
I think you are touching on one of the biggest failures of Germany and its criminal justice system, which at the time included many high-ranking judges who had been implicated in the Nazi regime themselves. And you can add to that bureaucrats in the Ministry of Justice who manufactured stealth amnesties for high-ranking SS men. For many years, these judges, these courts, upheld a very narrow definition of involvement. So you had to do something, hands-on. And this only changed really in 2000. So for the Auschwitz trial in Frankfurt, the prosecutor had tried to make Auschwitz one big crime in which everybody was implicated. that was rejected by the courts at the time. However, in the early 2000s, that kind of concept was tried again and it won. And that triggered the last trials that we see now. I think these are important trials, perhaps less because of the perpetrators, but more because of the victims. The victims who are coming to testify, many were very, very young, nearly children, when they came, for example, to Auschwitz from Hungary or to other concentration camps. And these witnesses in courts, they are participating, they have third-party representation. And they, again, tell their stories, they say what they feel about it. And these are very, this is very powerful testimony. And I think this is important. However, as you say, it will come to an end soon. And then Germany has to develop new ways of acknowledging and taking responsibility. So in a way, we have to transmit guilt into responsibility. And there are a number of problems. One problem here are new citizens in Germany, immigrants, for example, from Syria, from countries, in particular from Islamic countries, and how they become German citizens, they live there. And what you can see at the moment, huge conflicts about the Gaza war. But in essence, it doesn't differ substantively whether you never were part of that history or you do not have any living relationship anymore. So the distance to these events is in a way similar. So how can we deal with this? How can Germany deal with this? So you could say more education is necessary. Oliveira has in the introduction mentioned a lot what is going on, but I think that is not all. It will be difficult to convey the message that Auschwitz is part of everybody's history who are living in Germany as a German citizen. So one has to shoulder not the guilt, but the responsibility that comes with it. But how to do that? I think Germany is just very much struggling with that. How to do that properly?
Slušate podcast Fonda za humanitarno pravo. Kulture sećanja u dijalogu.
Genocides, war crimes, crimes against humanity are unique, as you know, in their context, in their space and time. However, you said that in one of your works that our ways of justice can be interrogated, scrutinized, juxtaposed, and maybe compared. What are the benefits of comparing different contexts across the time?
I would like to mention in this context Australian criminologist John Braithwaite. And John Braithwaite developed the importance of modeling. Models are very, very important. So if you think of democracy, that is a model that is transported, that is implanted. It was, for example, implanted in a way again in Germany by the Allies. If we look at the setup of parliaments, they are pretty much the same over a lot of countries, even if they are not that wonderful democracies. Crime policies are travel with their models, what to do, and they are modeled elsewhere. And traditional justice processes in all its forms have been one of the most successful models of the past decades. And they traveled the globe. If you think of, for example, Truth and Reconciliation Commissions, and they are often carried what John calls model mongers. So people who carry, who are sitting on a truth commission in Guatemala and then on another one in Africa or something like that. So there are a lot of models. I would like to stress that Germany certainly is not a model in that sense. So too much failed, too much was done too little, too late. In particular, reparations are a terrible chapter in this story. However, there are certain ways of doing justice, of doing memory, of doing truth-telling that can be transported to different shores. That is, these are more, this is not a wholesale model, but these are little kind of baskets of models or smaller models on where there is a huge diversity and there are different scales that can be compared. And we can ask, how do they work in different contexts? So I compared, for example, transitional justice mechanisms in complex conflicts. And I found two things that I thought was important, that transitional justice fails in reducing violence when it comes too early in a conflict. It cannot do a lot, obviously, then. And the other one, that also amnesties could increase, in particular, state violence, and then in reaction to that, also violence by others. So amnesties are not a panacea and do good or for all. So these are things that we can learn. Or, for example, in one article I compared how high-level, high-ranking perpetrators came back into society in Germany and in the Balkans and in as much as it was possible. And I used a case-by-case study. And what I could carve out was that indeed that, for example, that in Germany, former SS and particular high-ranking were barred from political or government offices. The low ranking all came back in, and that is another story. But at least those at higher ranks could not get back. Or at least they were already, if they got back, it was, for example, for a mayor in North Germany of a town, it was discovered and he was forced to resign. So this is, I think, these kind of restrictions are important, and criminal justice has such restrictions, for example, for sex offenders. Everybody agrees. Or, for example, for people who do white-collar crime, doctors. Yeah, they are barred from their profession.
Why people have a desire to deny the past of their fathers and grandfathers, and were there some in Germany who embraced the legacy of their family members and then dedicated their life to expose this difficult past and educate others about it?
I think that actually people, and we want our ancestors, our closest relatives being like us. We want them to share our convictions, to be like us. And this applies, of course, to fathers, grandfathers, to mothers and grandmothers, because also some people discovered that their grandmothers or mothers were deeply implicated, for example, as a warden in a concentration camp for women. And so since the 1960s, I think, the children of some of the defendants from the Nuremberg trials came forward, including, for example, the children of Albert Speer, actually. Also, some whose fathers had been executed, like Nicholas Frank, the son of Hans Frank, who actually figures quite prominently in Philip Sands' book, East-West Street. And this is now a powerful movement. I think it is one of the really powerful remembrance movements, which is promoted in memorial sites, and in particular in one memorial site near Hamburg. And they offer archival support. They offer groups where children or grandchildren of perpetrators come together, groups where victims can come together and where also they can meet. And they also, there are a number of publications from these activities. And I found one story particularly moving, which I would like to share here with you. So a man was confronted with a photo on a book cover about SS perpetrators. And on the book cover, on this photo, what he saw was that directly behind Himmler, who was in the center of the photo, there was a man who looked like him, exactly like him. And it took him 3 years, as he wrote, to approach the author of the book and to ask who that man was, and as he had suspected, it was his father. So he learned that. But you can see here the difficulty also that comes with it. But I found this story very moving because in the end he did it and he asked for it.
You said before that the Nazi regime made huge efforts to cover up and destroy any traces of mass killings in the Holocaust and to keep it secret, even among the German population. But perpetrators often felt the need to seek moral reassurance from their close networks. Why and how they sought to do so?
Yes, this not only applies to Holocaust, it applies to quite other contexts. So there are two ways to interpret this. On the one hand, we can interpret it as they want to show off to their communities that there are heroes in a very violent and difficult situation. You could think of today, for example, youngsters putting the photos or videos of their crimes on TikTok. Also think of terrorists who stream their action. For example, the Norwegian who killed that many young people, he streamed that. Others, or I think Christchurch, the Christchurch terrorist also did that. So that is one side. The other interpretation is a more subtle one. And I interpret this as a strong desire to ensure that such atrocious violence ultimately can be understood, because they know what they are doing. It can be understood. It can be accepted by others. And there would not be a moral condemnation by their loved ones and in their closest circles. So they want to have the support of community. And we see that, for example, German soldiers who took and sent back photos of mass killings to their families, notwithstanding that it was strongly prohibited to do so. Or people in the US South sent postcards of lynchings to family and friends to document that they were present with a little cross. Here am I, and there was the person, the lynched person. And about 600 of these postcards have survived. So we know that this is going on. And for me, therefore, this seems to be a universal trait that perpetrators seek the acceptance of the community, and perhaps also to relieve them from their individual sense of guilt. So I'm still supported. I'm still a member of this moral community, even if I have participated in this.
You said that what is to be learned about the past is that there are no bystanders, an easily adopted and comfortable category that we don't really discuss much, right, in transitional justice field. So profiteers, civil servants, administrators, professionals, scientists, those who oversee, order and organize are complicit in the crime. Can you please elaborate on this bit? Why do you think that bystanders... There is no really such terms as bystanders, that they're all, everyone is kind of complicit to different levels of the crime.
I think this is a good example for how we can compare, how we can learn from each other, or how new developments actually shape our understanding of these crimes and what can be done. So I think the category of bystander has been very much questioned with regard to the most recent justice processes and movements, for example, with regard to slavery or to settler violence in Australia, because these are things that implicate loads of people. So, for example, very recently, a very old leading newspaper of Australia, the Sydney Morning Herald, apologized for their reporting on a massacre, which was the only massacre where there was a prosecution, and their defense of the perpetrators. They just did it this year. So they felt implicated in this. And of course, for example, with regard to slavery, with regard to dispossession of land, suddenly universities are in the limelight. So there is, I think, and this clearly has repercussions for how we see implication in Germany in the Holocaust. And again, here, much more is coming to light and evidence is still emerging. For example, quite recently, photos from a small town in South Germany emerged, which showed how the neighbors, the inhabitants, citizens of this small town went after the Jewish people had been deported. They went to auctions to grab Jewish household goods, furniture, clothing, and so on. And I can tell you, these photos are telling. These are all very normal people. And in a way, they are not bystanders. They are profiteers, even if on a very small scale. And the same happened later in World War II, when the big cities were bombed and people lost their homes widely. And then trains with the goods of the Jewish people from the east and west of Europe were brought in there, and people could actually take, or at least equip them with new household goods. And they knew where it was coming from. They knew from where it was. So I think, and this is a good way of, yes, we can, things that happen in other contexts actually revise how we think about our own past and how we have to change and how we have to change our perspective.
My last question for you is, what individuals inheriting the burden of guilt can do to prevent future atrocities? And can we speak about inheriting not just the burden of guilt, but also the burden of responsibility too, to prevent future atrocities?
Yeah, guilt is a highly individual and, as we call it, self-conscious emotion. That is one that is in contrast to shame, which shows can show on the face, which is hidden, is not easily shared, an emotion that is not easily shared. The notion of collective guilt is highly contested, and it was never accepted by the German population, in particular in these surveys that I mentioned. It was rejected early on by about 70% of the population. And perhaps I think guilt needs to be visceral, related to sites and places or direct contact and encounters. Yeah, so you go to a memorial site, you visit Auschwitz, and there I think one feel, as a German person, you feel it. But of course, this all vanishes into a distant past. And it is important to transfer that into different ways of taking responsibility for the past. You asked about what individuals can do. I would like to start what actually also governments can do, who are implicated. For example, there are partially state, so-called state treaties between German states or Länder and persecuted people like the Sinti and Roma in Germany, and they are given the status of particularly protected groups, protected against discrimination and so on. So these are activities where states take responsibility, particular protection of groups that have been persecuted, in particular in memorials and so on. Also, of course, for Germany, it is support for the safety and security of Israel that is important here. On the other hand, you ask about what individuals can do. What we can do is to just engage, ourselves or in groups, to put pressure on communities and politicians, to reject denial, to be very clear about what happened. And truth always needs detail. And even if it is far away, I think exactly these details tell us how atrocities can be perhaps hopefully prevented. Knowing how they evolved is important for prevention. I think as individuals, we can be alerted. We can do something. We can do something like you do, Oliveira. I think that is important to give space and voices to different groups and how they think about it and bring it out in the public. And I think that is so very important.
Thanks, Suzanne, for sharing your fantastic expertise and knowledge with us today. We reached the end of our conversation today. This was the Memory Cultures in Dialogue podcast of the Humanitarian Law Center. My guest today was Professor Susan Karsted.
Slušali ste podcast Fonda za humanitarno pravo.